Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Talking Writing Podcast. My name is Sarah Tulloch, and I am the podcast production manager for Talking Writing. Today, we are speaking to Jeannie Blasberg. She's an award-winning and best-selling author and essayist. Her novel, The Nine, was honored with the 2019 Forward Indies Gold Award in Thriller and Suspense and the Gold Medal and Juror's Choice in the 2019 National Indie Excellence Award. Her novel, Daughter of a Promise, is a modern retelling of the legend of David and Bathsheba, completing the thematic trilogy she began with Eden and the Nine. Jeannie was named a Southampton Writers Conference Bookends Fellow in April 2021. A Smith College graduate, she is both a teacher of writing and a lifetime learner who co-chairs the board of the Boston Book Festival and serves on the executive committee of Grub Street, one of the country's preeminent creative writing centers. Jeannie reviews contemporary fiction for the New York Journal of Books, and when she's not in New England, she splits her time between Park City, Utah, and growing organic vegetables in Verona, Wisconsin. Welcome, Jeannie. Thank you so much for being here. So getting into that, I read the whole thing. I loved it. And I didn't realize it was the third in a trilogy. So let's start off with like why you wrote this novel and then how it fits into the series.
Thanks, Sarah. Well, first of all, I'm so grateful that you took the time to invite me here, first of all, but also reading the book before we had this conversation. I think your thoroughness and your attention to detail and like really wanting to have a quality conversation about the book is really only possible if you read it. My first two novels came out in quick succession in 2017 and 2019. This one took me a little bit longer. It publication-wise, it took me a little bit longer. Writing-wise, it probably took me less time. But both Eden and the Nine share some characters and share some setting. I've been obsessed with the idea of family dynamics, mother-daughter relationships, and mother-daughter-grandmother relationships. And I've been living with these characters from Eden in my head for so many years. They made an appearance in Daughter of a Promise as well. And so although I didn't set out to write a trilogy, that was never the original plan, I seem to be drawn to themes of being an outsider in a privileged world, or class, family relationships, inheritance, what we pass down, what we take on. It just felt like I wanted to revisit some characters. Obviously, my main character is a brand new main character, but I live in this imaginary world that started with Eden, and I seem to always go back to that summer beach community with my characters and in my books, and in a different way. It's not like the books can all be read as individual entities on their own, but for those who've enjoyed them, the recurring characters and seeing people at different stages of their lives and in different settings and experiences is kind of fun, and I get a lot of great feedback about that. So
yeah, that's awesome. I was very interested, especially in the beachside community. And I believe it's Ray, who is probably the main character for Eden, right? Like,
well, Ray was born in the last pages of Eden. So sorry, it's not a spoiler alert, but Eden, the timeline of Eden is one very hot summer in the year 2000 when a matriarch in a family is having to give the news that they may not be able to keep the house and the family anymore because of financial reasons, but also she really needs to give the news that there's another child in the family that nobody ever knew about. So that happens in the year 2000, and Sarah is Ray's mother, and Sarah gives birth to Ray kind of towards the end of that novel. So that novel really focuses on four generations of women and the different options and experiences they all had around unplanned pregnancy. So Ray is kind of the modern day situation where a young professional woman had no qualms about being single and pregnant and raising a child on her own, much to the like shock and horror of her older relatives. Anyway, Ray, as your readers or your listeners may find out, is my main character's best friend in Daughter of a Promise. But she brings with her all of the baggage from the family in my first novel.
Yeah, I felt like I could really see the entirety of her. Sometimes best friends are kind of just there for the main character and they just support the main character, but I felt like I could see so much of Ray's life, and it was just I thought it was really well done. Can you tell me why you wanted to talk about Bathsheba and David? There was a bit of the Bible that was, I believe, in the prologue that kind of contextualized things for anyone who doesn't remember the whole thing, but it's such a small passage, it seems like, and you were able to do so much with it. Just give me a little bit of why you wanted to talk about them.
Wow, I can answer that question in a number of ways. I'll try to touch on all the thoughts in my head and be somewhat concise. But I am a student of Torah from the point of view that it's one of our earliest and most rich pieces of literature. So many themes and plots come from that, and I'm not going to say, it's Western civilizations or the Judeo-Christian traditions' earliest piece of existing literature. And so, in studying the story of David and Bathsheba, probably in the year 2015 or 2016, I was just struck by how contemporary David and how the situation of an older, more powerful man and a younger woman was coming up in the news. It was the height of the Me Too movement, and I was like, change the clothes and the palace and the whatever. This could be on the front page of the New York Post right now. What happened? And so I'm a real believer that these relation the d dynamics of our relationships really haven't changed. The human situation and the human struggle, the trappings are different. We have technology. We live in different types of homes. But the way we love, the way we desire, the way we feel disappointment and want to belong and want to be loved, I just don't think those things have ever changed. So I like to go back and reuse a plot that's somewhat familiar, that's thousands of years old, as a way of saying, yeah, the human struggle, it continues, and we've been at this for a really long time. And unfortunately, things haven't really gotten better, whether it's from a female or a feminist point of view. But what I've done with this story and what I wanted to do after reading it and studying it the first time, it was completely written in a third person point of view, but with regard to David's life and what it meant for his life. And the whole time I was studying it, I was like, hold on. Bathsheba goes through all these tumultuous, terrible things, and there's no reference to her feelings, her reactions, her thoughts. How did she think about this man? And then I don't want to ruin, the plot for people who haven't read it yet, but she experiences great loss and she stays with David. So I was just like, I need to know more. So yes, there is a short paragraph that contextualizes the story in the beginning of the book, kind of as an epilogue, but it's really all there is in the Bible too. There's just not a lot. So part of my study and the people I study with were encouraged to expand and answer our own questions, and it's called Midrash, which is the pulling out. And so I'm kind of answering my own questions in this novel. Now, I set the novel completely in the year 2019, so It's not one of these biblical retellings where we're going back into an ancient time period or it has any religious overtones. It's really more taking this plot and repurposing it and giving it a parallel path in a contemporary setting, which I found fun as a writer and somewhat challenging as a writer. And yeah, it's just for those who want to see the story retold in a different, with a different voice. I write this from my main character, a young 23-year-old woman's point of view. Actually, she's a little bit older. She's telling the story of when she was 23 from a retrospective point of view. But yeah, I wanted her voice, and I wanted the book to kind of conclude with her holding a lot of power and the ability to decide what she wanted to do with her life, that staying with David wasn't a foregone conclusion, that she'd kind of come into her own and understood all that she could do and all she was capable of, and that staying with David was just one choice, but she had many choices at that point in time.
Yeah, I felt like you made the kind of sanctity of her choices like very clear. Like, she always took time to think about what to do, and whatever she did, it was in her mind and in real life like her choice. So I thought that was very well done. And the fact that, like you said, you answer a lot of your own questions, there's so much brought up that you can't get from that little paragraph from the Bible. Like, how would her mother feel? Who raised her? How would her coworkers feel? Like, how would her best friend feel? What resources are there? Like, you have so many answers to so many of the questions that are like logistical, but also like that make her a human being. So I thought that that was very interesting. You said that you were a student of the Torah. Can you talk about a little bit about that and like how that your research went into your book?
Okay, well, when I say I'm a student of the Torah, I converted to Judaism a little over 20 years ago. And part of the conversion process involves a lot of study and taking classes. And there's this one particular class that I've been still registering for 20 years later. And it's with it used to be women. Now it's people of all identities, and we meet with our rabbi, who is really my mentor and teacher in all of this. It's really during the academic year, not so much during the summer, but once a month, and we focus on a different person in the Bible. Or like, we've studied Jonah, we've studied Solomon, we've studied David, we've studied the women of Genesis, and so that's where I'm a student. And it's no surprise my first novel was entitled Eden. I do like to explore ideas of paradise, or, you know, all sorts of things that somewhat allude to these stories. I've always also loved being a reader of books that kind of have a rich texture in that they're in conversation with other works, so that my readers not only read the words on my page, but there's also a little connection to what the original story is. And so it's almost like being, I don't want to say being a footnote, but it's like I'm commenting on something that's really well known, and so that my comment on it is a statement in and of itself. For example, besides being a retelling of the story of David and Bathsheba, I have some allusions to Little Red Riding Hood. And so these fairy tales are cultural myths, and they are in people's minds. And so taking what's somewhat familiar and then putting my own twist on it, I think is, I don't know, that's the way my intellect works. I think it's a fun way to make the point I'm trying to make or ask the questions I'm trying to ask. In terms of research, I don't think there was really any research besides my own study of the story and conversations with some rabbis and further study of Proverbs. So Solomon is David and Bathsheba's child later, after this initial liaison they have. They have Solomon, who becomes the next king of Israel, and he holds the mantle of wisdom. And so I've structured my novel Betsabe is several years beyond the occurrence of everything that happened, and she's writing a letter to her unborn child. And in my novel's case, his name is Sol, and that's a wink to Solomon. And she's writing about this year because she wants to impart her wisdom on him. And my, you know, my preposition, I guess, is that wisdom is coming from the mother, not necessarily a gift from God. That's why we've got this wise man. But I guess I did study, and it was really like not with an eye of research, but over the years, there's been favorite passages or imagery. And I guess I insert that in very subtle ways, and some people might not even notice it. But the research really, I don't know, my character is a young woman starting off at an investment bank, and she's in an analyst training program, and she's got this feeling like she wasn't, her hiring her was a big mistake, and she needs to really work at figuring things out. And to tell you the truth, that I pulled from my own experience as a 21-year-old showing up on Wall Street being like, I don't know how I got this job, and I am like in over my head. So there was some personal experience that went into that. I also have several children who are in their 20s with friends who've taken similar jobs. So I did question people a lot. I also have a close friend, and I could have reached out to any doctor, but a friend who's a gynecologist and helped me with some of the medical accuracies of what happens. But otherwise, I was a freewheeling, imaginative writing person. I at one point, Anita Shreve, before she passed, was a mentor of mine. And one time she said that she only does enough research to help her move the plot along. She just doesn't get too bogged down. So for better or for worse, this book wasn't research heavy.
That's so interesting. Okay, you said something that I want to touch on. Betsabe, she is writing and passing on this wisdom to her son. What was it like writing to this future character? Did you have to withhold information, or did you had to put yourself in her shoes to see what to tell her son? Like, what was going on there?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, the device of having her write this as a letter was something I came up with in some of the final stages of revising the novel. I was trying to write 100% from this young 23-year-old voice. And I often found myself slipping into the older and wiser voice, like if I'd only known, and it was just incongruous. So I thought maybe the purpose of this whole novel, of everything that happened to my character Betsabe in this year, maybe this was to break her open to a certain wisdom that she needed to pass on. So I completely rewrote the book with that older, wiser voice. And to tell you the truth, that came more naturally to me. She is both that older, wiser woman imparting lessons learned to the next generation. And then when she's in scene, she's a little bit of that trying to figure it out, young adult, questioning herself, justifying decisions, like living in the moment. So I go back and forth a little, but I think it really solved the problem both for like why. So the ultimate question a writer asks is why? Why does this story need to be told? And why does my character need to be telling it now? And I think I solved that with the fact that she's pregnant with Sol, and she's a little hesitant and she's a little nervous given everything that had happened in the past. And writing this letter is her way of processing and her way of calming down her nerves and her way of spending her time in the final days of her pregnancy. So it really solved the like why question. And then it also, I think, helped because I have to tell you, even though some people are listening and some people can see this, I am ages beyond 23 and maintaining that voice of a young, pretty hip person I wasn't carrying it along in a steady way.
That's so interesting that you say that, because I felt like I could feel her youth when she's like in the scene, but I think that the wiser version of her also shone through as well. Like I felt like it was very balanced, because I was, even as I was reading it, I was like, this feels like a like all powerful kind of voice sometimes, like kind of like God speaking to any of the other characters in the Bible, and it's like you're kind of giving her that power to like im like the ability of for a woman to give wisdom is not often in the Bible, so the fact that you gave her this power was just like eye-opening for me, because I didn't think of Bathsheba really often. I grew up Christian. I know the story, but we didn't really like stay on her at all, you know?
Yeah, I mean, she was either cast as a victim or as a conniver. And I was like, no. Nobody is just a victim or a conniver. Look at what happens in the next scene after this story. She's working very closely with the prophet, Nathan, and is at David's deathbed and like making sure her kid becomes the next king. But she's also like, I don't know. I'd see her as someone who found herself in a situation that was very complicated and had a lot of innate power and knew with nuance and with like diplomacy and intelligence how to become, have it serve her the best. So I really wanted to write a book where my young character has agency and has some say in how this is all going down. She's not just a victim. She's actually chosen some of this, and she's not a conniver. She's actually seriously helpful and talented, and she has agency, both sexual agency. She's intelligent. She's loving. She understands the power of love and opens up to what love truly is. And yeah, she's kind of not perfect, but she's awesome. She's like, I also use the imagery of like a Wonder Woman at the end. She's powerful. And I try to use kind of that cartoon imagery to make the exclamation point at the end.
Yeah, I definitely felt that exclamation point, especially when I believe there was this flash forward to like this idea of her being successful, like a successful actress. Is that what happened at the end?
Well, she goes into the theater, so it's not clear if she's actually on stage or managing a theater company, but she has. So in the very beginning, as she embarks on that letter, she says she's not working because she just recently stopped working because her due date is right around the corner. So you know she's got some new career, and the implication that it has to do with the theatrical world. I would love to say that she is on that Broadway stage, but I didn't want to necessarily make that leap. But you can imagine it, right?
Yeah, even just the idea that she's in that field at all is very powerful to me, because it felt like, you know, there's this idea of like, oh, can women have it all? And it's like, in so many real women's lives, the answer is yes. She does do anything that she wants to do. It might take a while, but she does get there, you know? And I feel like that's not always wrapped up in a cute bow in like novels or movies or anything, but you see that she has her whole life, and then she does get that part of her life that she's been talking about for years. So, yeah.
Yeah, I do think that we can do way more than we think. We just can't do it all at the same time.
Yeah. That's the thing. That's the one caveat, but you still do get it all. So,
You certainly can, and you do if you're open and you wake up each day with a positive attitude. She certainly had her doubts as to how things were going, but anyway, I think she's realistic. So I don't think I've written a person who is totally unrelatable. She makes some kind of dumb choices, and she makes some great ones, and she takes advantage of some opportunities, and then she listens to her own heart. And so all those things wrapped together, I think, build somebody's character and their strength to move forward from those young adult years that are filled with ups and downs. And all of our years are filled with ups and downs, but kind of that those scary early adulting years. So.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about your process as a writer. Can I ask if there's anything that you're reading right now that is helping you write?
Oh, great question. So what am I reading right now? Well, there's this woman named Kim Chesney who wrote a book called Radical Intuition, and her latest book is Seven Steps to Opening to Your Quantum Intelligence. So I think that's nonfiction, obviously. It's somewhat self-help, but it is a really cool reminder that we're all connected with like this universal energy. And I do think that if you're a creative person, finding stillness and quiet and being open to, whether it's through meditation or another practice of just kind of being able to spend time alone and quiet down. But that nonfiction book is just a great reminder that we are connected in so many ways. There is a lot of creative energy, and there's help when there's a story that kind of start, you know, I'm working on a project right now, and it's a novel, and I'm not sure where it was going, like 50, 60, 70,000 words in. I'm like, I don't know about this thing. But then I started writing a chapter, and I was like, oh, this is it. Like, I think this is the meat of it. I'm going to go back. Like, this is why I'm writing this. So so that book is really helpful, has been helpful. I've been reading the classics. The classics are a good, you know, tutorial, like Middlemarch and Charles Dickens. And again, relationships. If for someone who likes to write about marriage and parent-child relationships, it's pretty fun to do that. And then next on my fiction to be read, I haven't talked about this farm I'm on much, but I've been reading a lot of farming books. I'm also interested in reading, I have some new fictional works that are queued up. Rumen Alam's new book. I think it came out yesterday. So I've got a lot of things queued up. But to tell you the truth, I'm a little bit on a nonfiction train these days.
That's awesome. Okay. I'm going to look up that book and listen to it because that sounds like right up my alley.
Quantum Intelligence.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been recommending it to a lot of people. Sometimes I can gauge in like the first 10 seconds whether they're thinking I'm crazy, but it is a really, talk about feeling empowered. We are all such amazing intuitive beings, and we are all keyed into everything there is to know. If we could just slow down and be quiet and be ready to receive, that is kind of the ultimate ideal as a writer too. Is to disconnect from the frenetic and chaotic. And I'm not saying, oh, this masterpiece is going to come out of your laptop on the first draft, but you start to really like get in tune with what you feel meant to write.
I like that. Okay. I kind of have a two-parter kind of question. You tend to have a very creative life. Like, you teach, you've gotten all these awards, you write so many books. How is life like for you, as we call it, like a creative lifer? Like, how has your journey been to this, like, for you? And then, do you have any advice for people who want a purely creative career?
Yeah. So on paper, it all sounds extremely aspirational, but I still get up every morning and have to find the motivation. I I'm an only child. I've always had a very active imagination. I've always had a very rich internal life. I easily spend time by myself. So being introverted and being happy with solitude, I think, is part of my personality, and that's helped. I'd say one of my biggest creative acts was birthing three children and being a mother. Growing a tree, planting a garden. These are all things that I feel like I, with love and attention, I feel very proud of. The novel writing is a way of expressing a woman's experience, whether it's a mother, a daughter, or a lover. I've felt this need to kind of codify my take on what it is to be human. And that's actually like been amazing. I started out as an essayist, writing a lot about like personal essays and my own life experience. But then I decided, actually, I'd like to invent and families and exaggerate. And so what I'm saying is, decide it t takes some time. Meditate, be quiet, go on a walk. What are you excited about? What is obsesses you? If you're writing about things that you really feel that are important or things that you're really trying to figure out, it's easier to sit down and put words on the page every morning. Like I said, I have to get up and find the motivation, and I've created a very structured life for someone who's so creative. I actually go through the steps of my ritual every day. Like, I wouldn't know how to live if I didn't like wake up, do my stretches, write in my journal, eat my little combination of foods, turn off the internet, well, go through my inbox, turn off the internet, start writing, eat lunch. Then I have these appointments. So I like to really regiment my day. And I think that's a luxury that comes with being almost 60 years old, where my kids are gone and I can protect, the way my day is going to go. That wasn't always the case. I have a lot of respect for people who write and have their brains dedicated to other challenging situations. So I definitely understand what I have right now is an amazing opportunity, and I try to never squander a day that I'm not traveling or I don't have any appointments. I mean, those are like a gift from God. I'm like, I can sit down, I can like think, I can write, I can walk. And so I try to never waste opportunities. But then again, I also try to read as much as I can and talk to people. We moved here to Wisconsin and bought this farm, and meeting my neighbors and people in my community has been such a broadening experience. I'm filled with wonder. I'm taking notes. You know, you have to live a little in order to have things to write about. And then you have to like read and write. And yeah, just like we said, you can have it all, but not all at once. I've been at this now with the writing for over, you know, for my entire adult life, really writing in some shape or form. If you're healthy and have the good fortune of living a long life, I think you will be able to write three books and win some awards and have a family and or whatever your choices are. It just takes getting up every day and like making a little progress. I'm definitely not someone who sits at my desk for 8 hours a day. I work in big spurts. I'm a spurt person. Like when it's NaNoWriMo or some big thing, yes, I'll do the 1600 or 2000 words a day, and that's super like fun because you can do anything in 30 days. But you have to be compassionate and forgive yourself and not feel like, oh, I missed Wednesday and Thursday. Now I stink. Now what's the point? You know, you can't create these expectations that are going to make you feel guilty or bad about your routine. Yeah, before I got on this podcast with you, I made some progress in a newsletter essay that I'm writing, and I got it formatted and I edited it, and I just felt really good about that. And maybe that was 30 minutes of like intense focus on something, but I've gotten something to a place where now I can do some more work on it. So, you know, I just find that bursts of intention and energy are sometimes overlooked. You don't need the whole morning spread out like a banquet. You can get things done in the margins. And some people need the big full-on day, but I think the most successful and prolific writers write on trains, planes, and hotel rooms in the early morning in their car and bits and pieces here and there. We even dictate a lot into the Notes app in our phone. That's, I do that a ton. I'll be walking, I'll have a great idea, and I'm just like, and I then transcribe it later.
Yeah, that's awesome. I do the same. I will like text myself some ideas and then go back to it later. So thank you so much for meeting me with me. This was an amazing interview, and I can't wait for everybody to listen to it. So thank you again for your time, and we'll be in touch, okay?
Okay, Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.